This is the continuation of another homily, the one on the presentation of the Lord, where we spoke about His mother above all, and then, by extension, about mothers in general. Taking that homily as our starting point, in our last talk we broadened the subject, so to speak, to the family. The family, because the mother is, in many ways, its main pillar. We spoke about how a mother should conduct herself if she is to succeed, what the family should be according to the will of God, and why so many people, in one way or another, fail in their effort to build a family, resulting in so many thousands, if not millions. Millions of divorces, of every kind. That talk the other day was not finished as it should have been, so allow me this evening to add, so to speak, a few more things around this same subject. What was left over, what I still had in mind to say, is the counsel of certain holy people, if we want to have a blessed family, what we must keep in mind. For example, and I'll put it to you in simple terms, St. Ignatius the God-bearer says this, all who marry men and women alike should be joined together with the blessing of the Church. You know how many so-called married couples are not even husband and wife because they were never blessed. Those words, and the two shall become one flesh, were never spoken over them by anyone who bears that responsibility before God to make them one. They remain two separate pieces, even if they have lived together for years, and there are many such people who live together unlawfully, they do not have the blessing of the Church. These do not belong among married couples. You cannot say, this is my husband, this is my wife. When she dared, if you remember, the woman who was once the Samaritan and is now Saint Fotini to say, I have no husband, when our Christ said to her, go and call your husband and come here. And she said, I have no husband. Our Lord answered her, thou hast well said, I have no husband, for thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. It is true, he says, you have lived with five men so far as your husband, and now you have a sixth as your husband, and he is not your husband. So here he says all who marry, men and women alike, are to be joined with the blessing of the Church, because otherwise the children they bring into the world will bear the consequences afterwards, so that their bond may be according to the Lord, and not according to fleshly desire alone. That is what St. Ignatius the God-bearer says. What often happens instead is that we tear down our own house, and then we take material from the ruins, from what has been demolished, and go to join ourselves to someone in the same condition, to build something new out of the rubble. It will not be something new, not out of the rubble. And then with no permission, no divorce, none of this and none of that, you cannot come with the blessing of God. God does not give you His blessing. Others, again, have their own interests in not being crowned in marriage. Sadly, I know one very elderly couple who have now been living together about 40 years without the wedding crowns, and they will not be crowned because she is a general's daughter and does not want to lose the pension, so that she can keep drawing her father's pension. I do not know how much she receives. For 40 years she has been uncrowned. You understand now how she will stand before the eyes of God. If she were some poor soul, I might say, well, I don't know, let the poor woman not be left out on the street. That is how she thinks of it. But she is not even poor in any case. Another holy father says, if young people would come to be married with their bodies pure and unstained, for this, after all, is the very purpose of the wedding crowns, that they crown people who have struggled and remained clean, who remain virgin, and it is for the struggle of their purity that they are crowned. With glory and honor hast thou crowned them. The other should rather be crowned with dishonor, not with glory and honor. So then let all who come to be married come with their bodies pure and unstained, and then the fear of God will be greater, the marriage more honorable, and their children full of blessing. The rest are the offspring of sin. Those other children are not the offspring of blessing. And he adds, the children are not to blame for anything, and your responsibility before God is great, O man. And he holds this opinion and says, if someone begins while he is still young to live without restraint, to live that kind of life and to consider fornication something natural, as some people say, then there is the danger that he will return to that dissolute life. He remembers the old haunts, and even after he marries, he goes looking for the same disorder and the same debauchery. These are the words of the divine John Chrysostom. Perhaps, as we have been describing it, this seems to you far-fetched and very severe, that a person should be pure until his marriage, perhaps. Many things have been dislodged from their proper place, and that is why they seem to us so hard to achieve. Saint Ignatius the God-bearer says that a young man should marry from the age of 14 before he falls into fornication and corruption. Second, the Most Holy Theotokos is the classic example of when a woman is in a position to bear children, from the day her monthly period begins, with a higher salary and a higher position. But now come the roving bachelor flats and the dragging on, and you reach 39 and never quite turn 40. And then she marries and waits to have a child, and they cannot bring it out even by cesarean section. Why? Because we have departed from the natural law that God has set for us. The people used to say, either marry young or become a monk young. That saying came out of wisdom, and for the one I answered earlier, who was asking me what if he does not want the child he will have to raise, either marry young or become a monk young. All by ourselves we have built the society we live in today, a life in which a person ends up with so many nooses around his neck that no one can get them off. Not even the sword of Alexander the Great could cut through it. Why? Isn't it a Gordian knot that we ourselves have tied around life today? Today we keep asking when she will be ready. She is still immature. She is this, she is that, she is too young, she is too old. Leave her be, leave her be. Does she really have to learn everything else in the beauty salons before she can marry? Leave her be, she has the instinct within her. God has given it to her. A cat knows how to care for her kittens. And where is a woman supposed to learn how to be a mother from a book? Leave her be, God knows. Do not intrude into the things of God with your human reasoning. Without God's blessing, you will do harm, you will. And look, for all our prosperity, for all our resources, for all our civilization, for all of it, and on there is still unhappiness, and 100% failure when it comes to the family. And that is because the basic conditions are simply not taken into account. So it is thought to be somewhat harsh, I admit. But know this, if you want to have the blessing of God, and beyond that, to have the church take you up. Notice how she takes the wedding crowns, how she takes up the crowns and gives them to God to keep safe, he says. Have you ever paid attention to the prayers at a wedding, or are you busy looking at whether the kumbhara, the sponsor, is pretty, and at what gifts people brought? That's what you're watching. Have you ever once listened to the prayers? The church takes the crowns up, because it says to the sponsor, take these and guard them, those crowns there inside the church. But what is he supposed to take, when they are already defiled from the very start, already dirty? They shouldn't even be brought into the church for people like this, people who have left nothing sacred and nothing wholly untouched. And drop that man's excuse, the idea that the man is allowed to be dishonorable while the woman has to be pure. Seriously now, where do you get that right from, man? Where? Don't you have a virginal membrane yourself? Don't you have virginity, just as women do? God will demand an account from you on the day of judgment for something you do without his blessing. The beasts have no virginity, no hymen, not the animals, not the birds, not the fish, man does. So if God set limits and boundaries here, that means he will also ask for an accounting. That is how I understand it. The prayers are beautiful, but we do not know their worth. When the bride enters the church led by the hand either by her father or by her brother or by the mother of some prominent person, the troparion of Saint Constantine is chanted there, on the one hand for the bond of father, mother, and son, and then in the moment when everyone rushes to shower them with rose petals and rice and the rest, at the very hour when the priest takes them and calls even upon the prophet Isaiah to rejoice at the virginity of the bride, the virgin who has been dishonored since the cradle. Dance, O Isaiah, the virgin, why should he dance? What does Isaiah have to do with this? Isaiah is the one who spoke about the virgin. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel. In other words, we are making a mockery even of Isaiah. Come here, you who rejoiced over that virgin, and rejoice over this virgin too. Bring us the joy you felt when you beheld the virgin who would give birth. Yet at this moment we have no virgin, neither man nor woman. The virginity of our most holy Theotokos bears witness against us. And if you mothers want the mother, the most holy Theotokos, as your protectress, then take care now. What you have done is done. Let your children learn. Let your children learn the words. Behold the handmaid of the Lord, be it unto me according to thy word. What do these words mean? In an instant she raised her hands. With her hands raised, she said, Behold the handmaid of the Lord, be it unto me according to thy word. Let it be so. I hand myself over, whatever you want upon me, within me, and so on. That is why I was saying to you a moment ago that patristic literature, the writings of the fathers, has spoken beautifully about this subject. Let me pass on to you a few of their reflections, in which they take up the position of our Panagia, our All-Holy Lady, and speak in her voice about this purity of virginity. Saint Andrew of Crete, for example, says, Behold, here I am, ready, there is nothing to hinder. My soul is willing, my womb is fruitful, for it is untouched, my ear is quick to obey. My soul is willing, my whole being is untouched, and I am kept ready for my Maker. Do you know who your Maker is, woman? God, and by extension, your husband. Have you kept yourself pure for your husband? I put this question to you again. Behold, I stand ready, and there is no obstacle. My soul is willing, my womb is fruitful, for I am untouched, kept for the Maker alone. For my Maker, I have remained untouched for Him alone. Behold the handmaid of the Lord ready to obey, fit for service, prepared to receive. Be it unto me according to thy word. And Saint Gregory of Nyssa, on the same event, says, Behold the handmaid of the Lord, be it unto me according to thy word. As a handmaid, I lie before my master's nod. That is, I am ready, at the slightest sign you give, to submit. As clay I lie under the potter's hands. I am a bit of earth, and he can shape me into whatever he wishes. As thou wilt, let thy purpose be worked in me with full authority. As thou wilt, in thy love for mankind, let this astonishing conception be wrought in me as a wonder. Be it unto me according to thy word. Saint Theophylact of Bulgaria says, Behold the handmaid of the Lord. Be it unto me according to thy word. I am a panel for painting. So, he says, I am a blank whiteboard that they paint on. Let the painter paint whatever he wishes. Let the Lord do whatever he wills. I am a blank whiteboard, and he painted upon it whatever he desired. That is how a woman ought to be when she comes to her wedding. And Saint Athanasius the Great says, Behold the handmaid of the Lord. I am a tablet being written upon. Let the writer write what he wishes. Let the Lord of all do what he wills, and in exactly this we are not consistent, and you know it, and so do we, knowing where we have come from, what goes on around us, what is happening to our children, what is happening inside our society. For such a family ever to flourish, and to bear what we would call blessed fruit, it simply is not possible. There is also a father of the early centuries, Tertullian. Those of you who do some reading will know him. You will have heard of him, and he says this, or rather, what he does is sing the praises of this kind of marriage, the blessed marriage, marriage entered into with purity, with virginity, with reverence. And he says, Where shall we find language fit to describe the marriage the Church does not join, and the marriage that she does join? That is to say, where shall we find the tears and the weeping and the words to speak about that first kind of marriage I mentioned a moment ago, the one that has no blessing of the Church? But where, on the other hand, will we find words to sing the praises of a marriage if the couple has come to the Church in the right way? A true marriage should be confirmed by the spoken blessing, sealed by the blessing of the Church. The angels should bear witness to it. There should not be even one angel to speak against it, and God should ratify it. That is to say, the marriage must be spotless, so to speak. Then that marriage is blessed. And further on, let me tell you something else. Someone says that true marriages are made in heaven. That is, God is the one who unites people. And down here what happens is the confirmation of it through their joining together. God has written it in his books, this man for this woman for this man, and so on. The marriage is joined in heaven. And remember the other day when I told you about two incidents, one in the book of Tobit and the other in the book of Proverbs. In both of those cases, it says that God is the one who gives the wife to the husband and the husband to the wife. We, of course, do not ask him, because we do not believe this, that God has providence for a person if that person entrusts himself to him as he ought. And also, as another writer says, if a person took care to make a holy marriage, then as a rule he would go on to make a holy family as well. Of course, some members of the family may break ranks, but in general terms, a family with blessed and solid foundations will be different. Because it is like a tooth, you can cover it with gold on the outside, and all the while the root has rotted, or the tooth is loose. That is how it is. If you dress it in gold, what comes of it? If the root is ruined, if it is rotten, nothing. And that is exactly what happens with many people who arrive at marriage and at life together. Now a few more thoughts on the subject of the family. From the family, one father says, the Christian family, the feet may go away, but the heart never does. Whereas when there is no Christian family, a person simply looks away and goes. He does not even want to hear about it. He does not want to pass by there ever again. People often leave, and then, because they do not find outside anything that can give rest to their soul, they remember the house, they remember the hearth, they remember the elder, even if they live more poorly, even if they live more humbly, without even realizing it. In their hearts, they're still back there, and they dream of it, and they long for it inside themselves, because, as I said a moment ago, all our civilization cannot make one person happy. Not one, because civilization doesn't heal the root. It patches things up from the outside. It decorates from the outside. Take a mule, take a little donkey, and load it up with gold. What will it be worth? It has no value at all. None whatsoever. Isn't that so? Does it give a donkey any value that it is loaded down with gold? Not at all. It is still a donkey. Let us not imagine that because we have managed today to cook in a pressure cooker, and the braid of onions we used to hang over the pan is gone, we have therefore achieved something great. Think how easily a man today can pick that same pot up, bring it down on his wife's head, and hurl a couple of blasphemies against the Most Holy Theotokos on top of it. And to do such a thing, happiness is not found there. Happiness is inward. Happiness is spiritual. That is why someone says, the proposals of this world are patches. Have love, have good behavior, have understanding for one another, have love. What they need is to have Christ. These things you tell them have love are patches. It will hold for one evening, because he was ashamed in front of you, and the next day the same thing starts again, because he does not have Christ inside him. He has nothing at the foundation. If love does not begin from the salvation of the soul, but only from the body, how can we have a better time? How can we enjoy one another? Then the whole undertaking of husband and wife comes to nothing. Paul, I see, in Romans 14:15, writes that Christ died for souls. Our own effort is for bodies. The family has an eternal destiny, and it has an effect on eternity. Persons carry eternal weight, since they are souls, and Christ died for them. And if Christ has value there where he is, and has value in eternity, then so do the souls of the family, who are in relationship with Christ. That is what this writer means, would to God. He says that families might grasp this age of ours above all this age of clamor and of ruin, and turn themselves toward eternity, because when a person is taken hold of by Christ, he immediately begins to think differently. He sees everything as refuse. He sees his destiny. He sees his mistakes. He sees what he has come to. He sees that he is nothing, that tomorrow he departs, that he may not see the morning. He begins to reflect, and at once a way is found for him to step onto the road. Further, the family that makes its home a heaven can be certain that it will make heaven its home. I do not know whether you are catching this point, so I say it again. The family that makes its home a heaven can be certain that it will make heaven its home. Whatever family lives from today as they live in heaven, that family's home will be in heaven tomorrow, and they with it. That is what I want to say. It will inherit heaven. What goes on in heaven today? What is it that marks out heaven compared with the earth? First of all, there is obedience. There is respect of one for another. Is there disobedience in heaven? There is no disobedience in heaven. Is there respect in heaven, or is there not? There is respect in heaven. Down here, these things are missing. For a person to make his home a heaven starting today, there has to be mutual understanding, mutual sympathy. Bear one another's burdens. When the wife is tired, let the husband carry the load. When the husband is tired, let the wife carry it. When the husband is tired and raises his voice, let the wife lower hers. If you give back to the other exactly what he gives you, you will tear the house down. What is needed is mutual understanding and a filling in of each other's lack. For the most part, this does not happen. If the husband shouts Alpha, the wife shouts Omega, Omega, whereas if the husband shouted Omega, the wife should have shouted Alpha, so that they could meet somewhere in the middle, at Mu. But for a person to do this, to create peace and love and mutual help in the family, and for a house to become a church, these conditions have to be there, and they are not there. They never examined these qualities before the marriage. First, you examine other things, social standing, money, good looks, the flesh, pleasures, the way a person moves, and so on. But the basic question, the one that concerns the soul, whether we are being united soul to soul, whether we are meeting each other beneath the blessing of Golgotha, that is the one nobody examines. Because marriage means Golgotha, it means the cross. Once the cup of honey, the honeymoon, has been drunk to the end, then Golgotha comes into view with perfect clarity. And that is exactly where courage and strength are needed. A person has to weigh up their responsibilities before they put their neck into the yoke beside another. Because the very word for a husband or a wife, a spouse, means someone yoked together with another inside one in the same yoke. We enter into one yoke, and remember, when Melissus pulls, Carus must pull as well. You understand the picture, don't you? It is like the village teams of oxen. And he goes on to say, family life is God's way of bringing up children. The child will not receive its formation for this passing life and for eternity in the colleges, nor outside somewhere, in book learning and the rest. Because all of that shapes the head, it does not shape the heart. The person who has not grasped this matter stops at knowledge. The child goes further so as to become a human being, and instead becomes a beast, because in the language of the world, a human being means an educated person, someone who has thrown the hoe out of his hands, someone whose hands no longer grow calluses, and so on. That is what they call a human being. That is what the world says. Human beings, yes. But to the degree that a person does not carry the qualities of a human being, that he is not reasonable enough to want to understand the things of his own soul, that he does not readily accept that another may be his better, that he does not place himself at the service of another, to that degree he is not called a human being, he only has the name. So then, family life is God's method for the raising of children, and it is the mother above all, with the father in a secondary role, who will cultivate and shape the human being. All the great men confess that they owe their success above all to their mothers, because, I repeat, the father is the porter, he is the guest in the house, he learns everything last, he is only there to carry the load. It is the mother who knows the secrets, she reads sealed letters, she reads the soul of the child, of the boy and of the girl. She is the one in a position to do it, not simply to hand the child over to a nurse, not simply to hand it over to some teacher over there, to be taught English or German, and so on. She will raise a beast, and she will weep bitter tears both in this present age and in the age to come. It is within a Christian home that a true family is formed, and there that a child is truly brought up. I would also like to say this, a person can endure anything out in the world, especially a man, so long as there is sympathy and understanding at home, so that he can find rest inside. When a man goes out into the wrestling arena, whether to gain certain qualifications so that he can work tomorrow and earn his living, it is like falling into the middle of a football pitch and having the players start kicking him about like the ball. One moment they knock him out for a corner. The next they send the ball out of bounds. One moment they handle him one way, the next another. That's what the arena outside is like. A woman doesn't know about these things, the Greek woman above all, apart from certain ones who have gone out into the world and work. In any case, a woman's kingdom is not out in the world, it is in the home. It is a failure that women have gone out into the world. Satan drew them out. God could have ordered things rightly. But because we do not ask him and instead rely on our own reason, we have failed in this respect. So if the woman stayed at home as a queen and made the house a place of warmth and comfort, then with all the exhaustion the husband carries and all the difficulties he has run into out there, even if he has been wounded, she could help him and bring him back into some kind of balance. Because God has given us sleep. You sleep 10 minutes and you are rested. The headache leaves you, the one that all the aspirin in the world could do nothing about. You get up with fresh strength and so on. How did that happen? It happened under a mystery, through a gift that God has given to man. My dear man, just imagine coming home to real human beings, your wife, your children, and the rest, who have cultivated themselves and learned how to receive you properly. Even if you come through the door like a lion, they will calm you down, and you will become gentle, because you have entered a blessed environment, one made suitable and just right for a person who is struggling with anger and suffering from it. Take note, the father may be angry. He may come home in such a state, while the family does not know what has happened to him, to say, but we have this to do and that and so on, simply will not do. Nowadays, the mother is doing her nails and staring at that demon box, that idiot box over there, and so on. And many times the husband comes home and has to serve himself his own meal. Is it ever possible that such a thing should be considered a married couple, a family, and so on, and that they should bring children through and build a family that could salt the rottenness that exists today and the dissolution of society? It is not possible, as you can understand. The builder of family life is love. Now, when we say love, your thoughts run to Eros, to the wedding cup. That is not what this love is. Love rests on sacrifice. Love is something else entirely. Real love, not satanic love. Not love that calculates its own advantage. Not love of the flesh. There are loves that have carried many people up to the Acropolis, and they died down below. The other love, the love that is sacrifice. So if there is no sacrifice, no real love can exist in the home. I once read something, and it seems I wrote it down in one of my books. There was a sick young man at home, and a woman next door had a grapevine, and the vine ripened its first bunch of grapes. She thought it good to cut that bunch and give it to the boy who was ill, her neighbor's son. And she did take it over at a moment when nobody else was there. She says to him, "I've brought you this little bunch of grapes. Thank you very much, Mrs. So-and-so, and so on." He set it up there on a little plate. He did not eat it. Then his mother came home from work at midday and sees a little bunch of grapes sitting there, and the young man says, "Mama, they brought me 2 little bunches. I ate one and I kept the other one for you. Thank you very much, my child, but you should eat this." "No, Mama, I ate mine. You eat the other one." "Let's save it for your father." And the mother didn't eat it either. She kept it for the father. And when the father came home from work, "Shouldn't we leave it for little Katina, since she's so frail," and so on. "He'll be so happy." And the father didn't eat it either. He left it for the little girl. And when the little girl's turn came to eat this sweet, she said, "Why don't we leave it for Georgie? He's studying from morning till night." They had a young child who was in school, and when it came around to little George, he did not eat it. "But I should not eat it. Christos should have it because he is sick." And so it made its way around the whole family, but not one of those present ate it. Where is there such love today, such sacrifice, such understanding of one another? Today we live in a jungle, a real jungle, where the question is, who will devour whom? So the builder of family life is love, and the murderer of family life and of happiness is the absence of love, the reverse side of love, coldness of heart, indifference, hardness. That is the murderer of family life and of its beauty. The family for the husband, as I said earlier, must be the harbor. The harbor where he finds shelter from the storms of life. Because for the most part, he is the one who takes the blows. He is the one who takes the pounding of the waves. He is the one who needs more care and attention. And you know, when the head is looked after and kept strong, the body is sustained. If the head is not looked after, the body is not sustained. This kind of love does not exist today. We hear women open their mouths so wide as though they were ready to swallow someone whole. Tell me, when you insult your husband, calling him a fool and saying he is this and that, you are insulting your own person. You are insulting yourself. Where does that leave you? Are you not one with him? Unless, of course, he is merely your lover, your adulterous partner. But if he is your husband to whom you were united beneath the marriage crowns, then he is your own person. He is you yourself. You cannot be understood apart from him. You are one. God joined you and made you one flesh. Who is it you are cursing? He is the strong half, while you are the tender half. It is your own face you are cursing. And the old people used to say, people who had no schooling, but who had the fear of God, if I spit upward, I spit on my own face. If I spit downward, I spit on my own beard. That is what it is. Who are you going to spit on? On yourself. As unworthy as you are. That's the kind of husband you ended up with, and you're the one who chose him. So where are you going to go and complain about it? Where did somebody put a gun to your head and force you into the crowning? What did anyone do to you? Where? And now all of a sudden you've noticed? Look, was he really from God? Did God really send you this man? And if God did send him to you, then again be patient and endure. For you have a reward, and there is a reason in it. But you did not do it that way. You arranged it all by yourself. That is why you get the opposite results. If we wanted to reflect a little, the exceptions in these matters are beyond counting, and we should take these things by the root, because we keep grabbing them by the branches. You know, it is like this, it is like that. Yes, but why is it like that? Let us find out why it is like that. Here the doctor comes and sits with you for 2 hours to take your history. Doctor, why are you asking me now what happened in 1910? Fine, just answer what I'm asking you. On the basis of your history, he will work out why you are suffering today. Go to the asylum today. You have the psychiatrist here because we do not want our spiritual fathers, and the psychiatrist hears your confession, and you take out pen and paper. What I did with that one, what I did with the other one, how many children I killed, this and that and the other, and there you make your confession. And you pour out the whole of your filth and everything within you to a man who has no power to do anything for you. Nothing, apart from handing you a fistful of pills, he can do nothing for you. Matters of the soul are not touched by medication. They need spiritual treatment. They need Saint Gerasimos. They need Saint Nectarios of Aegina. They need things like that. Fasting, vigil, prayer. Yet you confess everything there. While you will not go to confess to the priest, who has the power to help you and grant you absolution. Everyone wants to learn your history, to have you confess your sins to them, so that they can see why your soul is weary, what it is suffering from, what has weighed upon it, what sin has come over it and crushed it in this way. So, if a person is not willing to examine himself in depth and say, "My God, yes, it is so. You are right, I made this mess myself. I brought it on myself. I never asked you. I thought I had simply turned up here in the world by chance. My father and mother's pleasure is what put me here. That's what I thought, and that I could run things myself, and all the rest of it, and I've tangled it all up. Please take it." And he takes it back again. He takes it back, but these are matters of a different kind altogether, matters that no reasoning can solve, no human love, no sacrifice. What solves them is repentance and acknowledgement. No one has ever turned to Christ and said, "I was wrong, my Christ. Yes, you are right," without finding mercy. God has countless ways. He takes Satans and makes them angels. and he can turn angels into devils. God is accountable to no one. Do you repent, O man? Then you untie his hands. You let him work, but you remain in sin and refuse to move. You don't move, so he won't make you bleed, so you won't end up killing yourself. You sit there and let the man work that little buzzing drill inside your mouth so he can drill into your tooth. You stretch out, you lie back, and you surrender. So why don't you surrender to Christ? Why don't you surrender to Christ, who has the power to solve your problems? Cast all your care upon him. So take your little sack of sand, the one that weighs you down and drives you all the way to suicide. You measure, you look out the window to see how many meters it is to the ground so you can jump. Take this little sack and give it to him. Say, yes, I did it. He rejoices to take our sacks. He rejoices to take our sacks. But who believes these things? And who actually does these things? There are such cases. Continuing with these thoughts, our family circle. Our family circle is a royal setting. The Christian family circle is a royal setting, provided, of course, that Christ reigns there. Often we peer through the shutter to see who is knocking, and if the person does not do us the honor we think we deserve, measured by our own logic and our own measuring tape, we do not open the door to him. Or if we do open, we send him round to the back entrance, the servant's door, and we imagine that this is how we can pick and choose and build a household of standing, a blessed home, a happy home, a joyful home, and so on. Nothing of the sort. Where Christ is not present, there is no practical love, there is nothing at all. A home is like a royal court when the people living there are Christians. You see the blessing, you see it in their faces. Even if their mouths remain closed, their faces speak, the little children, the husband and wife, the grandfather, everyone. But what is missing is this Christ who changes souls and, through the souls, changes faces as well. That is why you walk into a house and think you have walked into a madhouse, and you do not know where to take cover. And however many smiles are scattered about, and however much they try, out of mere formality, to cover over what is boiling underneath, it comes to nothing. To the crafty and to the good alike, it is obvious that nothing there is standing upright, that there is no family there. Another definition along the same line of thought is this: a Christian family is also the one in which Christ is honored as a member of the family circle. Let me say it again. Listen to it. A Christian family is also the one in which Christ is honored as a member of the family circle. When you go into a house and Christ is not there as a person, as a member of the family circle, everything is different. No, I do not prove that I am a Christian simply because I have an icon, and have even fitted it with an electric lamp that stays on day and night. So Christ will not complain when my oil lamp sometimes goes out, or because I light a candle or go to church. You must see Christ in your home as a person, as someone truly present there. If there are five of you, see Christ there beside you as well. No, I do not prove that I am a Christian simply because I have an icon, and have even fitted it with an electric lamp that stays on day and night. So Christ will not complain when my oil lamp sometimes goes out, or because I light a candle or go to church. You must see Christ in your home as a person, as someone truly present there. If there are five of you, see Christ there beside you as well. Because when you see Christ beside you, then you will pray properly, and at the table you will pay attention to whether it is a Wednesday or a Friday, and to what you have put on it. And when you go to bed, you will be aware that Christ sees you as a person, and in the morning you will think about going to church, because if you go after the third bell, you might as well not go at all, and he knows it, and he sees it. And when a woman puts on a man's trousers, or stands in front of the mirror deciding that this or that suits her well, if she sees Christ as a person, if she sees him, a person will not do such things. No deceptions either. No shady schemes. Would he do it? Would he act that way? Would he say it? Would he carry it out if he saw Christ standing there? I remember once in another of our talks I said something about this. There was a man who used to pull off shady deals, schemes and frauds, that is. Whenever he saw someone whose business was failing, he would run to someone else and say, "That man is going under. This is our chance to take what he has, to buy it all up and fix it up. Come on, you put up the money, and I'll make something out of it too. So one morning he knocked at the door of an office. Inside was a major businessman. And unfortunately, certain people have been allowed to take such liberties. Even a general cannot simply walk in, but this man can because he knows some of their weaknesses. And he says to him, "Come here, come here," before he's even said good morning. So-and-so is going under, so come on. Let's buy up his goods at half price, and so on. Here's our chance to make a killing off him. But strangely enough, at the edge of the desk, Christ was standing there, upright, and the man who had just walked in did not see him, while the man sitting inside the office did see him. And because he could see Christ standing there, he says to the other man, "I'm not going to do this." "You're a fool," the man says to him. "Forget all that. That is how they talk. They are brazen about such things, and other people have handed them that license through other frauds, other shady deals." And he tells him, "I can't do it. Don't push me." The man brazenly hurled a stream of abuse at him, insulted him, and so on. Then he slammed the door, adding a blasphemy for good measure, and said that he would go elsewhere to people who knew how to take advantage of such situations. The moment that man left, the Lord turns to him and says, "You did well. You did not give in to this. It is a good thing if you can help someone who is going under. But no, the Lord tells you, you did exactly right. Whatever you can earn by your own sweat, that is what lasts. That other money is not yours. It did not come from your own sweat. And at the same time, you are not helping that man in the ugly business he is doing. In both cases, he did not sin, because he was seeing Christ there. We in our homes do not see Christ. We do not have Christ with us. The proof is this. There is no fasting, so Christ is not there. There is no prayer, so Christ is not there, neither within us nor around us. There is no willingness to bring children into the world, so Christ is not there. There is no honesty, no morality, no modesty where all these things are missing. Christ is missing too. He should see Christ as a member of the family. And if he does see him as a member of the family, then the conversation opens out and goes further. He'll ask, "What did we do for Christ today? My dear, where is the plate? Come now, didn't you set out Christ's plate today? And Christ has brothers. Look, didn't you put anything aside this week? Something small, so we can send it over to those who have nothing. Christ also has people who are in need. He has widows and orphans because this is the real issue, and here every one of us is guilty. If a man sees Christ in his home, things will change for him and for those outside as well, because he himself will become the reason that those outside are blessed too, out of the blessing that is inside that home." Let us stop here for tonight and, God willing, continue in the next talk.